Dr. Donald Gilbert is a graduate of Princeton University, cum laude in philosophy and moral sense theory. He attended medical school at the University of Michigan and then completed his residency program at Johns Hopkins and did a fellowship in pediatric neurology, also at Johns Hopkins. He completed later a Master of Public Health while on faculty at Cincinnati, where he's still housed, but did the Master of Public Health up at Michigan, commuting back and forth to do that, which I think is an incredible dedication. He's board certified in neurology and pediatric neurology, has published about 30 articles in peer-reviewed journals and numerous other abstracts and chapters. Many of these involve ADD and ADHD, but many also involve Tourette's syndrome itself. So it's an honor and a pleasure to have him here to speak with us on Tourette's syndrome and educate us a bit on psychiatric aspects that he will add into his talk as part of this training from the CDC. Dr. Gilbert.
Thank you, Dr. Solomon. Thanks especially for a nice lunch. It's very nice to be here at Vanderbilt. I found when I've given these talks in the past that the orientation and training of the attendees varies a lot, so I hope this talk will have something in it for everybody. I'm at Cincinnati Children's, where I have a large Tourette clinic, which forms the basis for a lot of my research and also the experience I have treating this that I'll be sharing with you today. The practical aspects for those of you who prescribe medications are all in the handout. In fact, pretty much everything I'm saying today is going to be in the handout, except for a few transition slides that I've thrown in and also some videos that I'm going to show. So in terms of actual dosing, I didn't think it was that exciting to go over that. That's all going to be at the very end. But we can and we'll have time for questions at the end. Also feel free during the talk to ask questions about the topics. All right. I only have one disclosure. I have an investigator-initiated grant from Lilly. I'm not on any speakers bureaus, and I don't do any consulting. I will be discussing off-label uses because that's unavoidable. I work at Cincinnati Children's. This is actually a wonderful place. It's the first place I went after my residency. It's been growing continuously since then. At Cincinnati, the Tourette Clinic is actually in neurology. It's been there traditionally. It started out with Brian McConville, a psychiatrist, and Harold Fogelson, a neurologist. When I came, I worked with Randy Salee from psychiatry, and now I pretty much have run this clinic myself, where I follow a very large number of Tourette syndrome patients and also patients with other problems of movement, such as dystonia, chorea, ataxia, tremor, and myoclonus, and some of those are occasionally confused for tics, so I'm going to go over that a little bit today. The objectives of my talk are on this slide. We're going to start out with phenomenology and kind of make sure that everybody's on the same page in terms of diagnosing Tourette syndrome correctly. Then I'm going to describe treatment indications for tics, talk about some practical aspects of treatment for Tourette syndrome, and during the talk in several places I'm going to talk about some hot topics currently in Tourette syndrome, including genetics, PANDAS, which stands for Pediatric Autoimmune Neuropsychiatric Disorder Associated with Strep, and deep brain stimulation for Tourette syndrome. So in neurology and movement disorders, we always like to start out with phenomenology, and that's partly because most of the things that we see, similar to what psychiatrists see, have to be diagnosed without medical testing on the basis of experience, clinical observation, and physical examination and history. So tics are patterned repetitive movements that look the same or sound the same each time they're performed. Tics are little motor programs, whether they're vocal or motor, and there are a variety of examples. And if you look around any elementary school classroom or you go to the mall, it's very common to see somebody that has some kind of a tic. But the best way really to learn about tics versus other movements is to see examples of them. So I'm going to show you a couple examples of vocal and motor tics.
Can you say the days of the week for me? Okay, I want you to speak a little bit more slowly and say the months of the year.
Ah! So most kids that have a tic have a characteristic sound that they make that sounds the same each time. And as you can imagine, if that's the tic that you have, that's a fairly disruptive sound to make. A lot of kids that you see, though, have some other kind of a simple tic that they do that's not that disruptive to their life, but it is concerning to the parents, such as these two boys have.
What do you like to do for fun? Can you say the days of the week?
So if you practice family medicine or general pediatrics, or if you see kids, most of the tics that you're going to see are similar to something on here. They're going to involve the face, maybe the neck. It's going to be fairly simple, involve just a few muscle groups. And as you notice already from these videos, if you give the person a task to do with the same set of muscles where their tic is, they tend not to do the tic during the task. They do it before or after, which is a key thing that separates tics from some other movement problems. Subjectively, you should always talk to a kid or an adult that has some kind of a movement they do and ask them how they experience that or why they do it. A lot of kids are initially reluctant to do that. Kids under 7 often are not aware that they do their tics. But at some point, most people, for most of the tics they do, people have an experience of the tic that they have an urge to do their tic and they're actually doing it. So it's not a completely involuntary movement disorder. And this boy, I think, explains that nicely.
Do you feel like you're doing it or it just happens?
I kind of feel both. It feels like I'm making myself blank, but I'm trying to escape control. But I'm making myself blank. I'm making myself do it, although it just kind of wants me to do it.
Can you stop that? Is it difficult?
So he's got this, he actually has a kind of a complex series of things that he does, and he feels like he's doing it, but he can't really stop it, but he's doing it. He's sort of just coming to the awareness of his own body and his own mind that this is something that's kind of in between voluntary and involuntary. So some people actually consider tics disvoluntary or involuntary, something that's kind of sitting right on the border, because you can postpone them, but you can't really stop yourself from doing them. Tics have a certain progression through childhood and adulthood in most cases. In most cases, people are not ticking before age 3. They start at some point later than that. And that's actually very important when you're assessing comorbidities. They tend to wax and wane, and most tics that kids get, they're not going to keep that long if they're young. So they're going to have a tic in a certain body area, and that's going to go away, and they're going to get a tic in a slightly different body area. So they wax and wane in frequency and intensity, and they migrate in location over time. That's standard in kids. They peak, unfortunately, around middle school age. That's a tough time socially for them to peak. Yes?
Why after 3?
The question is, why do people tic after 3 as opposed to some other movements that tend to start before 3? I can't give a great answer for that. I think it probably has to do with maybe myelination of the frontal lobes or connection of, just development of the brain in some way. There's a lot of conditions in children, for example, absence epilepsy or benign melanic epilepsy, that tend to start at a certain age, certain symptoms of Rett syndrome. So the developing nervous system reaches a certain point where the pathology of the disorder or disease can become manifest. So they tend to peak actually in middle school years for a lot of kids, which is socially a tough time to have them peak. And then in 9 out of 10 cases, they're going to diminish after that. So I see, I'm at a children's hospital, but my clinic is open to adults with Tourette syndrome. I probably see 10 kids for every adult I see, and I think that adults are understudied in terms of their Tourette's, but in general, the data show that most kids are going to have their symptoms improve and may even remit in adulthood. Tics occur during the day. One thing some people don't realize is tics actually can occur during sleep. Most movement disorders don't occur much during sleep, but during light sleep, some kids will do their tics, and the parents will observe that. They also have certain patterns of exacerbation. Anything that's hyperkinetic is going to get worse during stress. Tremor, for example. Chorea. Tics definitely get worse during stress, but kids can often, and adults tell you other periods where they notice that they tend to tic more often. So in summary, the key features of tics are that you can think of tics as being a motor program. And it's something that's performed in a semi-voluntary way, but that rarely interfere with voluntary movements in the same body area. Now, in central nervous system disorders, we like to think about where is the lesion. So this is not particularly practical with the exception of the surgery issue that we'll come back to. But we are kind of interested as researchers or even as clinicians in where this problem comes from. In other words, what makes people tick? So I'm going to talk briefly about what we think we know about the neuroanatomy of disinhibited motor programs. So the movements that people do that are tics are very easily imitated because they're little learned movements. They're little bits of behavior that are programmed in, and they're waiting in the brain to be activated instantaneously. And so they're pre-assembled and ready to go. And what's supposed to happen when we all wake up is that some systems activate that hold those movement patterns in. So we have a braking system, and that braking system then gets turned off so we can do movements that we want to do. So that braking system probably resides in the basal ganglia, which I've represented as basal. Now, it turns out the basal ganglia, which have an important role not only in learning routines but also in movement inhibition, the basal ganglia are very vulnerable, selectively vulnerable to a wide variety of insults. So, for example, mitochondrial diseases may just affect the basal ganglia, carbon monoxide poisoning, mild hypoxic ischemic injury, certain metabolic diseases, inflammatory diseases. So the basal ganglia are a target for a lot of different types of pathology. And, of course, any area has its own genetic vulnerability. But if something happens to that area such that it's damaged and it's smaller, or it somehow functions in a different way, what would you expect would happen? Well, if you understand the wiring of these structures, you can predict what kinds of things would happen. So the basal ganglia are connected to the cortex and the thalamus and the midbrain through a variety of pathways, which are called the direct and indirect and hyperdirect pathways, which are shown here. The main projection neurotransmitters are glutamate, which is in green, and GABA, which is inhibitory, in red. And so these pathways are shown in this little cartoon. And this is essentially a pathway that you activate every time you do a voluntary movement, which connects cortex to subthalamic nucleus, striatum, globus pallidus, externa and interna, thalamus, and back to cortex so that you can do a movement that you want, a voluntary movement. There's a more complex version of that, if you're interested, in a very nice paper from Jim Lechman and colleagues in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. I just got this figure offline. This is the same schematic that I just showed you in a little bit more complicated form. We still have cortex, striatum, globus pallidus, excitatory and inhibitory pathways. There's the indirect pathway right there. But what this shows is a couple of extra things which are important. One is there are a number of other areas besides motor areas which are connected through these same circuits, including areas important for cognition and emotion. The other is that within the striatum, there's actually a complex patchwork of striatomes and matrisomes and neurons that fire at various rates. So the last thing that's critical to mention is dopamine. And I'm ignoring serotonin and other neurotransmitters that are acetylcholine. But in this simple model, the other key factor is dopamine. So dopamine is released into striatum and into cortex. I'm just showing striatum here. And as a result of the dopamine release, you have downstream increased glutamate that's flowing back to the cortex. So dopamine drives movement. It's critical for learning. And it's also probably playing an important role in what is salient. So that problems with dopamine may be related to issues with reward and addiction. So if we understand all these circuits are interconnected, we also understand that if you have a problem with your basal ganglia, you're not just going to have movements usually. Most of the time, you're going to have some other problems with disinhibited behavior that affects your cognition and affects your emotions in some way. And that's certainly what we see in Tourette syndrome. Now, I want to diverge briefly into some non-tic movements which are occasionally confused. And the first one and main one I want to address is stereotypies, because I not infrequently see somebody with stereotypies that thinks they have tics or has been told sometimes for decades that they have Tourette syndrome when they don't. Now, that's an understandable mistake because stereotypies, like tics, are patterned movements, but there are some key differences. So stereotypies, although they're patterned, are almost always complex, involving both sides of the body. Not a simple movement like blinking or eye rolling. And they can also be done in a prolonged series of repetitive stereotypies where the child or adult will dissociate from their environment. And again, I think this is best seen with a series of videos. Now, stereotypies, unlike tics, usually start earlier in childhood, often before age one. So what I'm going to show you here is a series of kids at different ages doing their stereotypies, and I'll give you some commentary. Okay, this is a little boy under age one. He's 5 or 6. He still does this. He rocks his head back and forth and flaps, and he does it with an exciting toy. So he's got a flashing toy there. This boy clenches his abdomen, extends his arms, and flaps his fingers next to his shorts there. He's got an exciting book he's looking at with his grandmother. It's subtle here, but more dramatic at home. Now, this boy is not normal. He has autism. He does his flapping movements and paces in the same fashion, and he'll dissociate and pace for a half hour at a time. You can stop him. You can pick him up, call to him, make him stop, but he's angry when you do that and wants to go right back to it. So these are not tics. This boy kind of has a sensory aspect to his. He likes to posture his hand, which he does when he's excited, but also when there's light in the room, and he likes to look through his hand at the light in a certain way. This boy brings his hands to the midline, almost like you see in Rett syndrome. He incorporates a toy with it, bites his hands. He's otherwise normal. And this is a young man with Down syndrome that has kind of a self-stim rocking and flapping that he does with a toy. Okay, so tics and stereotypies are both patterned, but they have some key differences, and they tend to happen in different kinds of kids. So tics, pattern movements, start after age 3, brief, wax and wane, migrate, location over time. Stereotypies are patterned, start before age 3, persist relatively unchanged for years. The only thing that changes is when kids do it. And they also occur in certain emotional states which parents readily identify. For example, excitement, or going into a situation where the child is overwhelmed, or sometimes boredom if it's more of a self-stim. So those are the key things. The other key thing is that both of these tend to happen in kids with some other kind of a comorbidity, but the big thing to watch out for with stereotypies is PDD, NOS, or Asperger's. So with stereotypies, there's actually not anything that we do therapeutically, or medically, I should say. I think the key thing that I find in clinic, if I see somebody with this, is that very often nobody has given the family a name, or even the person a name, for what this behavior is that they do. They find it very comforting to know that this has a name, other kids have this, and what the natural history is. And what's going to happen with stereotypies, typically, if they persist into age 3 or 4, is the kids are going to keep doing this in early elementary school. Parents are going to be mortified that their kids are going to be bullied or teased because of this. But if the kids are socially normal, if they're not autistic or they don't have Asperger's, they're going to realize around 3rd or 4th grade that the other kids don't do this. And they're going to stop doing it at school in front of the other kids. So the older kids, except for the Down syndrome adult, the older kids that I showed you, they don't do it around other kids. So kids that I see, they're in middle school, if they admit it, often say they still do it, but they just do it like when they walk in the door and they get home, and they don't do it in front of the other kids. And in 1st and 2nd grade, no matter how weird it looks, the other kids don't care that they do that. So they don't get teased in early elementary school for stereotypies or for tics. There are a few other things that are occasionally confusing. Sometimes dystonia can present with tics. Something that looks like tic could actually be myoclonus, automatisms, simple partial seizures. Most of the time, it's not going to be one of these other less common problems, but the bottom line is if you're not sure, refer. Have a colleague that you trust that's good with the phenomenology of these movements and refer to that person. That's much better than ordering diagnostic tests, which are often unnecessary. I'm going to digress briefly into a hot topic from this past year before we go on to clinical management, and that's genetics. It's long been observed in families with Tourette syndrome that it runs in families. That's true for a lot of things in the DSM-IV, but it's especially true with Tourette's, and it looks in a lot of families like it's autosomal dominant, and also that there's some gender effect because males are 3 or 4 times more likely to tic. Now, interestingly, despite that clear inheritance pattern, and despite a lot of NIH funding in genetics, do we have a major gene yet for Tourette syndrome? We don't. Do we even have a very good LOD score for Tourette syndrome? We don't. So this is a complex disorder, whether people like it or not. But there's been a debate going on since probably the mid-80s, maybe before, about the nature of Tourette inheritance. And one of the key issues when you've got pedigrees that you're looking at for linkage is deciding who's affected and who isn't. Now, one view of Tourette's syndrome is that it's tightly linked to obsessive compulsive disorder. It's linked to ADHD, but not in the same genetic way. And the people that you decide are affected are those who have Tourette's and OCD. That's the view, I think, that's been predominant in the genetic studies. Another view, which Dr. Cummings and others have, is that Tourette's is on this spectrum of disinhibited behavior or compulsive behavior that also includes compulsive gambling, substance abuse problems, just anxiety, a whole variety of DSM-4 diagnoses, and that you have to include those as affected when you do your genetic studies. Now, neither of these approaches to this point has really worked. What has and was published in Science last year is a different approach, which is a kind of a get-lucky approach. Get lucky and be smart approach, which Dr. Matthew State and colleagues at Yale did. And what they did is they found somebody with a chromosomal inversion. They speculated that the patient with Tourette's with this chromosomal inversion and breakage, that breakage might be the site where a gene that caused Tourette's might lie. And they were able to find a couple of other patients that had that same gene and a mutation in that same gene. And that gene was SLITRK1, which is involved somehow, it's not well characterized yet, in arborization of dendrites. I don't know if there's a gender effect or not. This is very early work, but it was very exciting. It was published in Science last year. And so this is the only gene that's convincing for Tourette syndrome right now, though it probably doesn't affect a large proportion of the patients that we see. Okay, back to the clinic. So Tourette syndrome, if you're in general medicine, or tics in general medicine, are divided into several categories. I think probably in psychiatry, you're not going to see as many of the transient tics. Although if you're following somebody with anxiety or OCD, they may at some point in childhood develop a tic which doesn't last that long. So many kids develop tics for a short period of time, and their official diagnosis is transient tic disorder. There are other people that carry one tic or two tics, like blinking maybe, throughout their entire lives. That's not that common. That's chronic motor tic disorder. But most of what I'm going to talk about from here on out is Tourette syndrome. Oh, and the last category is there's a lot of nervous people that just tic. There's a lot of patients that I get referred that have conduct disorder or pretty bad psychiatric problems, and they develop a tic, and so they think they need to see neurology, or maybe they're just desperate for one reason or another to see somebody else. But really, in that context, the tic is a hangnail on a broken foot. So it's not something that really requires that much intervention. Transient tic disorder is kids who just have a few tics, usually less than a year. Occasionally, they can have very severe frequent tics, but still just do it for less than a year. Tourette syndrome, which is in the DSM-4, has a set of criteria which I feel obliged to mention, even though I don't agree with them. The main one is two or more motor tics or one or more vocal tics. The vocal tic is the sticking point. So when you make a sound, how do you do that? You do it with your muscles. If I go like that, I just contracted my diaphragm. How is that really biologically any different from contracting my diaphragm in a slightly different way so that I don't make a sound? So technically, you're supposed to have a vocal tic, but if you're in clinic, I wouldn't get hung up on that. It's quite possible they had a vocal tic, like a sniff or a cough, at some point, which is gone now, that they didn't realize at the time was a tic. So really what Tourette's is, you don't need to get hung up on how many vocal tics they had. What Tourette's is this is a person that has a brain that shows a chronic tendency to have a variety of tics, and the tics are unremitting. So tics consistently for a year is arbitrarily the cutoff. The typical pattern is that the frequency, intensity, and so on migrate in location over time. It's not a static process in childhood. The onset's supposed to be in childhood. Occasionally we see adults that seem to have adult onset, but I think in a lot of cases they had mild tics as kids that they're not so aware of now. And then it's not supposed to be iatrogenic or a symptom of another diagnosis like Huntington's or chorea or some other neurologic problem that has a lesion. There's one more criterion in the DSM-4, which is not in the DSM-4-TR, which is impairment related to tics. Again, that's not really a biological criterion. So, okay, in the clinic, practical approaches. I think there's a lot of room to criticize the way all of us practice. I'm sharing an email from a recent patient who has Tourette syndrome. The boy has Tourette syndrome, OCD, and ADHD, all three. And the mother shared with me that she felt that working with the psychiatrist was a struggle, And she said it was because the psychiatrist didn't really listen to her son, just listened to the parents, wrote prescriptions, and sent us on our way after a 15-minute appointment. I've been seeing a lot of Tourette patients for almost 8 years now as my main clinical area, and I still struggle with how much time my patients need or how to do it right in terms of new and follow-up visits. There are a lot of practice models out there, but many times the families, the patients with this, see the MD as the head. And if the head is spending only a few minutes with them, and then even though they may be spending a half hour with a therapist of some kind, they feel very dissatisfied about what's going on medically with their child. That's an experience that I've had. So here's what I do. I think I really try to get to know the kids on a non-Tourette level. Spend some time with the kid, find out what their interests are. That's actually key for treatment of movement disorders anyway, because you're always judging the impairment of the movement disorder based on what the person does anyway. Let them know that you've seen plenty of other patients with symptoms just like this. They may think that they may be the only person they know that has this, which is one of the great things about the I Have Tourette's But It Doesn't Have Me video, is that kids who've never seen anybody else with Tourette's can look at a dozen other kids with the same symptoms or worse symptoms than they have and see some positive role models in those kids. Find out what their friendships and activities are like, and then bring that information up at the next visit. So how's baseball going? How's basketball going? Are you still playing the piano? That means a lot to the patients that you see and their families. I take a very careful family history in clinic. I always write out the pedigree with the squares and the circles. Males are 3 or 4 times more likely to tic. Females are more likely to have OCD. So sometimes a pattern that you'll see in clinic is a boy who tics, a mom has OCD, and maybe mom's brother or father has tics. And if they're adult, if they're parents' age or grandparents' age, they may have never been diagnosed because diagnosis was a lot less common then. Now this actually has some implications for how you treat families also. If you're seeing a kid that's impulsive and ticky, and mom has OCD, or dad, and likes everything to be just so and under control, that can be a difficult temperamental match. And if you realize that going in, you may realize, hey, this parent's going to need more time than I think they need to discuss this because they're so obsessive about the symptoms and they're just ruminating over and over about the tics or the impulsive behavior that they're observing at home. And I agree, when I first started my career, I was split evenly between movement disorders and epilepsy, and I'm no longer in epilepsy. But my Tourette clinic has way more psychopathology than my epilepsy clinic ever did in the family histories. The examination should be normal. The general examination should be normal. The neurologic examination should not have any dystonia, rigidity, athetosis, should just have tics and maybe the kind of subtle findings that you see in lots of kids with mild developmental problems. Now, routine diagnostic testing. In the medical field, parents often have expectations about testing. Here's an email that I got recently. My son so-and-so is scheduled for a visit with you, and he's going to be getting an EEG, MRI, and blood work, none of which I had ordered. He's been ticking for 3 years now, and no testing has been done. So especially parents, I think, but adult patients also, they're sure there must be something in their brain to explain their symptoms. Well, the answer is there is, but we just don't have a technology that is very helpful to look at that. So here is the routine testing that I do for Tourette syndrome. I very commonly get a call from a family physician, a psychiatrist, a pediatrician, whomever, saying, hey, do you think we should get an MRI on this kid? He's doing really poorly. And I say, no. And then, not infrequently, it gets ordered anyway. And maybe there's some kind of nonspecific finding which becomes a crisis, like a teeny area of gliosis, which has no clinical significance that we know of. So, no genetic testing, no imaging, no EEG. Don't order EEGs in these patients. The purpose of an EEG is not to figure out if something that's going on might be a seizure. EEGs are used in patients that you know clinically have epilepsy to help define what kind of epilepsy they have. You should not order those to figure out what something is. I'm not talking about inpatient video EEGs, but routine interrectal EEGs have so many false positives and false negatives that it's a big mistake to order those willy-nilly on patients with movements. Also, I don't routinely order any labs. I don't check ASO or DNase-B, which are antibodies to strep, group A beta hemolytic strep, and ordinarily you're not going to need to order ceruloplasmin to look for Wilson's or any other rare conditions in these kids, or thyroid studies. Okay, let's move on to treatment. indications for medical treatment. First of all, the movements, as we discussed, need to be ticks. Second, they should be persistent. If I get a call that the ticks have been bad since yesterday when Johnny visited his father, I'm not going to treat those ticks, because if I did that every time, I'd look like a great doctor, but a lot of times those ticks are going to diminish on their own. So an exacerbation needs to last for a while before you decide to treat it. Now, a lot of families think that just because the ticks are present, they need treatment. And this is also true in teenagers that are obsessing about the fact that they have these ticks, and even some neurotic adults that we see. They just want to not have any ticks. But that's not why we treat ticks. We treat ticks because they're causing a problem for the quality of life of the person that has them. So often in a first or second grade kid, no matter how frequently they're ticking, there is not a thing wrong with that kid's quality of life. He's playing baseball, he has friends, his friends don't care in first or second grade what he does. The only people that care are the adults. And we're not going to put a kid on Haldol or any other medicine because the parents are worried about teasing that doesn't exist. So look for interference and then decide, is that interference bad enough that it's worth trying medication or not? And the typical kinds of interference are functional, which is not that common, and I'll show you some other examples. Social, which is more of an issue later in teenagers and adults. Pain, because of a vigorous tick, and this is an example of that. So this kid looks like he's going to snap his head right off with his tick. So kids that have ticks that look like that, if they persist, often are in pain. Adults who have a lot of head and neck ticks are in pain. They may be overusing NSAIDs or other things. These are situations, obviously, where it may be better to treat the ticks than to be taking pain medicine all the time. So treatment is not just pharmacologic. You also need to think about getting the rest of the patient's life in order and think about their comorbidities. So here are some common things that I think you should think about. One is sleep. Sleep is disrupted in all kinds of behavioral disorders. So think about, can you help their sleep in any way? It's multifactorial. A lot of families have this pattern of, like, if parents have split up of, you know, Johnny gets to sleep in bed with mommy, and or he gets to play video games in his bed at night, or watch TV at night, or all kinds of things that just sound ridiculous. But parents and families are allowing that to happen. So if you don't get sleep fixed, you're going to have some persistent symptoms. Physical activity, you know, people that are hyperactive and impulsive need some kind of a physical outlet. I think that's obvious. But in my practice, unfortunately, it seems like more than half the kids, when I ask them what their hobbies or main things they do are, the only thing they can think of to say, because the only thing they actually do besides homework, is play the PlayStation or the Xbox, which I think has almost zero brain value. So the thing that's different about that kind of a kid and the kids that are in this I Have Tourette's But It Doesn't Have Me video is every one of the kids in this video has something that they do, dance, music, sports, what have you, which shows that you actually can do all those complicated things despite having tics, and you can be successful at that. And that's going to help your self-esteem a lot more than your score in the Xbox. So I recommend that all the kids I see get involved in some productive activity. If they've got a pain condition, sometimes there's an interplay with that and their tics, so you need to think about that. And then a really critical one in middle school, when tics are getting worse, is how they interact with their peers. This is something that you can do in 2 or 3 minutes with the patients, and sometimes that results in you not needing to treat their tics at all. A lot of junior high kids understandably want to look and be just like the popular kids or the other kids in middle school or junior high, and they're worried about their tics, and they're spending all day at school trying to hide their tics, which is impossible. And they're spending a lot of mental energy trying to hide their tics, which means they're also not hearing what the teacher is saying. And they're maybe feeling sad or depressed about their tics. So what I tell all the kids, I start telling kids this around third grade. Say I've got a third grader in clinic. I say, Tommy, who's your best friend? Tyler. Does Tyler notice your tics? I think he might, but he doesn't say anything. Well, you know what? Starting in fourth grade, some of the kids are probably going to start saying something about your tics, because that happens in fourth grade. So you're going to have to think of what you're going to say. So what would you say if somebody asked you about your tics? And kids a lot of times have already experienced this, and they'll say, well, I just tell them it's a habit, or I say, no, I don't, or I just ignore them, or I tell them it's a condition, or all kinds of things that kids say. And a lot of that doesn't help. And then some of the anxious kids, when kids ask them, they cry, or they tear up, or they blush, or they're really embarrassed, which is not helpful for a junior high school student to do. So the approach that works is to just tell the other kids, I have Tourette syndrome. and not, and sure, there may be kids that think of, you know, Tourette's syndrome and they think of some caricature they saw in the movies, but that's okay. The kids can then work to correct that. Some families I know have actually shown this video in school to the other kids, which has helped a lot. But I think the kid that can just look up here in the eye and say, yeah, I've got a mild case of Tourette's syndrome, makes me do this blinking thing. The doctor thinks it'll probably get better when I get older. Those kids adapt much better and are much more resilient with their Tourette's syndrome than kids that spend junior high trying to hide it. In fact, sometimes the kids have a positive response. One of my patients told all the buddies on his tennis team finally that he had Tourette's, and their response was, cool, show me some of your tics, man. So a lot of times it's a lot better than the kids think it'll be. Other environmental issues, make sure the school understands about Tourette's syndrome. The Tourette's Syndrome Association has wonderful resources for that, which will save you a lot of time in clinic and result in better care for the patients. For example, in this video, there's actually an educator, Sue Connors. There's a lot of free that talks about how to talk to the school about Tourette's syndrome. A lot of states have a Tourette's Syndrome Association where parents have been trained to do an in-service in the school to talk about tics, ADHD, and OCD, and help educate the educators about the symptoms the kids are having. So I use the Ohio TSA constantly in our clinic, and I give all the patients the 800 numbers and the websites for the TSA. Medical treatment. Those of you who prescribe and who read the literature have probably noticed that there's an awful lot of small trials in Tourette syndrome. The effect sizes and the side effect rates in these studies are suspect, really. I think that the literature about Tourette's tells us several things. One is that so far, major pharmaceutical companies aren't that interested in finding better treatments to reduce bad tics. I'm not sure why that is. I think there's probably an economic reason for that. But there are almost no big, there's really only two studies with over 100 patients in all the Tourette literature, despite the fact that many, many different agents have been tried. Usually studies like this start out with an observation or a small open label study. Almost always, the effect that's seen in the open label study is much larger than the effect that's seen in the placebo-controlled trial, to the extent that I almost think the open label studies aren't worth even reading. But I am going to emphasize a couple of studies that I think have been helpful. The other thing is, if you want to look at this in a more comprehensive way, the Medical Advisory Board of the Tourette's Syndrome Association reviewed all the literature and did an evidence-based guideline. And guess where it is? In here. So if you fill out your evaluation, you can get the evidence-based guideline on this disc. They used kind of the typical categories of evidence. Class A, what meant it was supported by randomized controlled trials, although unfortunately for Tourette's, that means usually like one or two trials. B was supported by one randomized controlled trial, and C was anecdotal or open-label studies. So there are only three medications which are category A for tic reduction. All of them are dopamine-blocking agents that are fairly potent. So pimazide, haloperidol, and risperidone are the only three that met that level of evidence. What about category B? Flufenazine, which is also a dopamine blocker, ziprasidone, 20 to 80 milligrams, clonidine, pergolide, Botox, and metoclopramide in parentheses, because it's not in the guideline. The study came out afterwards, but it fits those criteria, so I added that. Class C, category C, olanzapine, baclofen, nicotine patch, mecamelamine, ropinirole, which is another dopamine agonist like pergolide, levetiracetam, which is an anti-seizure medication, and ondansetron, where all have studies supporting, open-label studies supporting tic reduction. There's some general principles which are helpful in all populations with multiple comorbidities. One is, please only start one medication at a time. In my view, that's the best way to go about it. You may feel quite confident that there are two conditions that need treatment, but my experience has almost universally been when I see a patient that's been put on two medicines at once, there's low efficacy or some kind of a side effect, and it's just unclear what's going on. So start out with one medication, reassess, start low, go slow, facilitate realistic expectations. A lot of families and adults, when you start medication for tics, they think the tics are going to get better and go away. That's not what happens. And that's rare for that to happen, I should say. The category A medications, the dopamine blockers, which are the strongest but also have the highest risk of side effects, the average reduction in tics is 25 to 50% in those studies. So that means they're still going to have lots of tics, and they're still going to have to talk to their peers about it and live with the fact that they have tics. So if they're calling because they're still ticking, it may be because that's as good as it's going to get right now. They're going to still tick. So when you start a medicine, when I start a medicine, I always let patients know, you're going to still tick. The other thing is that just because there's Class A evidence, remember that's based on efficacy. That doesn't mean that's your drug of choice. So I almost never start dopamine receptor blocking agents as a first agent for tics because of the side effects. What I start with is actually Class B evidence medications, which is clonidine or guanfacine. And in the back of the handout, I go over the exact dosing that I use. And what I tell them is that there's a 25 to 50% chance. These are probably harmless long-term, 25 to 50% reduction. They may not work for a few weeks, and that they may help with ADHD and aggression, and that the main side effect, particularly with clonidine, is going to be sedation. So why do I tell them that? Well, I tell them that based on one of the only two studies with over 100 patients. This is the TAC study. It was published in Neurology, so you guys wouldn't read it. And that study was done by the Tourette Syndrome Study Group, which is a group of neurologists and psychiatrists that participate in multi-center trials. In that study, which stands for the treatment of ADHD in children with tics, 136 kids during the school year were randomized to get either clonidine, methylphenidate, both, or placebo for 16 weeks. Now, since 1983, on the package insert for stimulants, what does it say about Tourette syndrome? Contraindicated, right? You're not supposed to use stimulants in Tourette syndrome. So there have been some studies in the 90s, but this was the first big study to really look carefully at whether or not that was a reasonable statement. It's still on the package insert, but that was put on the package insert based on case series. I think it is actually true that some patients will tick more on stimulants or will start ticking who weren't ticking already. But the vast majority of kids that have ADHD and tics together, you can treat their ADHD with stimulants without making their tics worse. And that's what was found in this study. So what happened in this study? Well, in the clonidine group, tics got better compared to placebo. That was not surprising. What was a little surprising was the ADHD also improved. In the methylphenidate group, ADHD got better. That was not surprising. What was also very surprising was the tics got better. So the methylphenidate alone group had a reduction in tics. Why was that? We don't know for sure. It could be that dopamine agonists help tics. Another option may be that if you have ADHD that's untreated, you're under a lot of stress. And if you get your ADHD treated, you're under less stress, so you tick less. Or maybe patients just joined the study at a time when their tics are bad. But we had a placebo group in this study, and these separated from placebo. So the methylphenidate group had fewer tics. Okay, so here is a figure showing the results. On the YGTSS is a clinical scale used for tic severity, and that shows that there's a reduction of starting out at 40 is the score. So the treatment groups are reduced by about 10, so about a 25% reduction in tics. And then the ADHD teacher scale there that they used, the ASQ teacher, also showed a reduction in all groups. The one main criticism I have of this study is what I think you should ask yourself when you read any of these studies is, if I had a kid with these symptoms, would I participate in this study or not? And then, do the kids that actually participated represent my patients in clinic? Now, 75% of the kids in this study had predominantly inattentive ADHD or ADD. So that's not representative of my population, but I think it's understandable. If you had a really hyperactive, impulsive kid, would you put him in a placebo-controlled study for 16 weeks when your alternative would be just to go to the physician and get a prescription for that anyway? Probably not. Not often. So I think a lot of these really scientifically rigorous studies may be enrolling kind of milder patients. Flufenazine, pimazide, or risperidone are helpful. I meant to show a different slide here, but again, with these, for example, the study by Scahill and all at Yale of risperidone showed it's clearly better than placebo, but the reduction in tics was only 25%. So you're going to get weight gain, and you're not going to make the tics go away. OCD. OCD symptoms are and anger may be some of the worst symptoms that families have to deal with in Tourette syndrome. And this does persist into adulthood. In fact, a recent study out of Yale showed that the peak of OCD symptoms is usually later than the peak of Tourette symptoms, of tic symptoms. And that's particularly the case in the higher IQ patients in their cohort. We don't have a specific OCD treatment trial to refer to in patients that have Tourette syndrome. But we do have the POTS study, which I think you're probably all familiar with. This was published in JAMA, and I really like the way that they looked at their data. They looked at reductions, but they also looked at, quote, remission. So they define remission as a CyBox score of under 10. Under 10, meaning that you're sort of no more obsessive compulsive than some of your peers. Now, what percentage of patients in that trial reached that endpoint? And that's what's shown in this figure. So in the placebo group, only 3% did. The silver bar is for sertraline alone, and this is in expert hands, about 20%. So 80% of patients that got prescribed sertraline by experts were not in remission with their OCD. The next bar is the CBT group, and last is the combined group that did the best. So, in summary, remember most, yes?
Was that a group of Tourette's patients with OCD, or were those OCD patients?
Yeah, so the POT study is just OCD patients, and it's the best we have, even though it's not Tourette patients. So the so that was in JAMA. Most kids with tics, actually, I think, don't need medication for tics. They need medication, if anything, for their other symptoms. We need to facilitate realistic expectations. And remember, medical treatment doesn't, as far as we know, affect adult tic severity. Now, what about this PANDAS thing? Who here has heard of PANDAS? Okay, so the idea is based on rheumatic fever. So rheumatic fever is a complication of strep infection that's accepted, where certain individuals are susceptible after group A beta hemolytic strep to get an autoimmune mediated, probably inflammatory disease that can affect the joints and give you arthritis, the kidney and give you nephritis, the heart and give you carditis, or the brain and give you brainitis, also known as Sydenham's chorea. So the idea is, well, patients sometimes get a severe exacerbation of tics for no clear reason, similar to the onset of chorea. And in both cases, there can be OCD or emotional symptoms. So couldn't it be, and they both probably come from the striatum, so couldn't it be the case that bad Tourette's could start with a strep infection? That's the idea. Now, Sue Sweeto at NIMH has set up criteria for this, and I encourage you to apply this, because what's starting to happen, which should not happen, I don't think, is that patients are getting this diagnosis after a single episode, and we see this in the literature. We accept that for rheumatic disease. We should not accept that for tics. Because unlike chorea or arthritis or carditis or nephritis in kids, tics are common. And lots of kids have explosive tics after a whole variety of triggers. So you're going to way overdiagnose PANDAS if you diagnose based on one episode. There should be a should start in childhood. There should be a sawtooth course. But the key thing is they should have symptoms for a year and should have onset or one exacerbation or two exacerbations after strep, not one. Now, the other thing was that Dr. Sweeto thought she saw minor choreiform movements in these patients. So I'm just going to show you some examples of Sydenham's chorea, because I think chorea is not that common, so you may not know what minor chorea looks like.
I'm going to ask you just to do a couple simple things. Okay, Tommy? Can you put your arms out like this and spread your fingers wide? Good. While you're doing that, keep your hands straight out like mine. Stick out your tongue. Wide as you can. Good. You did a great job with that. Keep your head like this. Straight up and have your palms face each other. Have your hands face each other. Excellent. Okay, bring your hands back down.
All the way down.
Left hand right on your thigh.
These are Sydenham's chorea patients. So they don't have tics. These aren't, you can, but these are not pattern movements predominantly. These are continuous random movements. Do they interfere with function? You bet. You ask these kids to do something, the movement doesn't stop like tics do, right? It continues right on through. In fact, movement makes it worse. It affects speech, tongue protrusion, spooning of the hands, patients always pronate. So this is the paradigm for PANDAS. So I think people who overdiagnosis maybe need to know what the paradigm actually is, because there's supposed to be a subtle version of this in the PANDAS in the PANDAS patients. So they have continuous random movements that interfere with function and significant restlessness, and it's usually asymmetric. Now the problem, I think, with PANDAS right now is, for one thing, the marker for PANDAS is anti-strep antibodies. If you go in any elementary classroom, you're going to find some kids with elevated antibodies. I saw a kid recently who was on antibiotics to reduce the antibodies, which makes no sense. So we have a nonspecific marker of this condition. The cause is very common, and the effect, the alleged effect, is also very common. The markers are nonspecific. The paradigm for this disorder differs in cardiac manifestations. So far, no PANDAS patients have had any cardiac problems, whereas the Sydenham's chorea patients often do. And then the other thing is that the standard of care for chorea is to put kids on penicillin until they're 21. Now, in the PANDAS literature, they report that when you treat these kids, they get better with antibiotics. That doesn't make any sense. And in fact, we don't see that in rheumatic chorea. So I don't know why antibiotics are being reported to reduce the tic symptoms in these kids unless there's a placebo effect. I think the big issue is, should they be treated with immune-modifying therapy? Right now, I don't think there's good evidence that they should, based on the single study in biological psychiatry by Perlmutter. And the other question, another study in biological psychiatry this past year by Suido and et al. Actually, she's the senior author of azithromycin versus penicillin, also was not a well-done study. It was just 23 patients. So I don't put any patients on chronic antibiotics. I don't recommend tonsillectomies. I don't use IVIG, plasmapheresis, or steroids for kids with bad tics. What about deep brain stimulation? When would you consider that? Basically, you would consider that in somebody that's got, in young adulthood or later adulthood, pretty severe unremitting tics. As bad as his tics are, look what happens when he does a task. So when you see miracle cures on TV, make sure that what's being cured miraculously is actually Tourette syndrome.
When do you think that you tend to lose? When I'm laying down.
He's a professional singer.
Any other times?
When I'm singing.
Okay. How long can you stop singing while you're performing?
It's according to whether I'm singing. If I'm singing a new song, I don't have it partly at all. I don't have it at all, probably. If I'm singing an old song that I know pretty well, I have it unless if I'm really concentrating on the audience and I'm looking at them and I'm thinking about the song, then I don't have it. But if I see a black person, or if I, because I have that same anger, if I see that, especially if it's a black person, it just goes into my mind and it just stays there until I say the word. So.
What's the worst tick that you have right now?
What do you mean, like when I'm out?
The one that bugs you the most that you have.
Just lifting my dress or touching myself. Those are the two things I thought.
How can you do that?
Because it comes into my mind. It comes into my mind, and when it comes in, then it's like I have to do it.
So there are some case series published. The locations that are published so far are globus pallidus and thalamus. I think there's a case of nucleus accumbens. There may be a subthalamic nucleus case. We've got some case series. What happens in the case series of these patients that have unremitting tics that are either socially really impairing, self-injurious, or violent tics is that it looks like the most severe tics diminish. The tics do not disappear. They just diminish, and that's shown in this case. This is actually two cases here. This is in this month's movement disorders where patients got either GPI or thalamic stimulation. Thalamus is the straight line. GPI is the dashed line. They're fairly similar. And the patient, and on the left is the tics, on the right is the OCD. The thing about this surgery is you can turn the stimulator off and you can bring a blinded rater in who doesn't know if the stimulator's on or off. And so you can, that's what's shown here on the x-axis is on, off assessments. It's a little tough with Tourette's because the symptoms don't immediately change when you turn the stimulator on or off, but that's how the research is done. So the take-home point, I think this is an exciting thing for patients whose symptoms are never going to get better probably with medication, at least with the ones we have now, but it's not a routine intervention. It's 2:16. I have an email that's in the handout. I'm always happy to answer questions by email if something comes up, but I think we have the room until 2:28 and 30 seconds, which would mean that I could take some questions right now. Thank you. Yes?
In OCD, it's maybe important to distinguish tick-related OCD and non-tick-related OCD. And the question is, how do you distinguish between a tick in the setting of OCD and anxious or distinctive mannerisms in OCD?
So the question is, in patients that have OCD and ticks together, how do you identify that something is a tick versus some other complex behavior that they do repeatedly? And I think that is very hard sometimes to do. I think of it as a tick is essentially serving itself. So usually if somebody has a complex behavior that you're wondering if it's really a tick or not, and you ask them why they do it, they get a feeling that they have to do it, or an itch, or some kind of an urge that's similar to the feelings they get before their other ticks. Whereas if they have a compulsion that they do, in response to an obsession, they will tell you what the obsession is that induces them to do their ritual. And if they just have some kind of a nervous mannerism, I guess I'm less sure about that, other than that it may be, the nervous mannerism may be more situationally triggered, whereas tics may occur just more frequently throughout the day, irrespective of, they're worse when you're anxious, but not as much when you're not anxious. Yes.
You know, but I did a paper on Gigalot Tourette when I was in med school. One of the things I remembered is that I think I remember, is that he described the tics in almost like mass hysteria proportions, and I think in Canada and Malaysia, I think. Was there some sense that tics may have been epidemic at one point? Would that relate to the pandas at all? Have you seen anything like that recently?
I wonder, I'm not sure exactly what you're describing, but the places that you mentioned, Canada, I mean, there are some emotion-triggered movement disorders in those, like the jumping Frenchman of Maine, which is different from Tourette syndrome, and there's some, I think, Malaysian populations that have emotion-triggered physical outbursts or jumping or flailing movements, and I think that's a distinct problem. Yes?
In adults, what's the effect of alcohol on the tick?
Question is, does alcohol change tick severity in adults? I think it changes people's perception sometimes if they drink a lot of alcohol, but I'm not sure if it changes the manifestation the way it does for essential tremor. So I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of adults that overuse substances, and I have a number of them that tell me that marijuana reduces their tics. I haven't ever had anybody tell me that alcohol reduced their tics. Have you had patients tell you that?
I'm just wondering about the incidence of substance abuse in this population.
Yeah, I think it's higher than the population for a variety of reasons, but I don't think it's because they're self-medicating to actually reduce the tics. But on the other hand, I have some adult patients that I've inherited from various sources that are on really huge doses of benzodiazepines. So I think there is a GABAergic, you know, mechanism involved or way to modulate the symptoms. Yes?
Are your children with Tourette's more likely to have learning disabilities?
Question is, do the children with Tourette's syndrome have a higher incidence of learning disabilities? That's definitely the case in my clinic, which probably has ascertainment bias. I think the best studies that we have of that, one was done in Rochester, the other was done in Montgomery County, Maryland, where trained observers went into classrooms and they looked for tics in students, and then they compared the rates in the special education classes versus the regular classes. And the rate in the special education classes of tics was about twice as high. Yes?
This is from a non-medical person asking this question, but is it possible that for you to have the Huntington disease gene but be like a carrier and not have Huntington's disease? And are people that are like that more likely to have Tourette? Or is that, is everybody ever correlated with, you know, the,
so the question is, are asymptomatic carriers of the Huntington gene more likely to have tics or Tourette symptoms? The Huntington's gene is autosomal dominant, so if you live long enough and you have the mutation in the trinucleotide expansion, you're going to get Huntington's. The first symptoms are usually psychiatric. And some of the kids that I follow whose parents have Huntington's, they have a lot of behavior problems, but we aren't testing them for Huntington's on the basis purely of psychiatric symptoms in childhood. I don't think they would be more likely to have tics, but they might be. They probably would, slightly more likely. Thanks very much for your attention.